Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewey de Boer and William McGimpsey. I hope you enjoyed the previous segment where I was the one being interviewed by William on Japan. And if you're listening to this on the replays later, go and check that out if you haven't already. But we're switching places again. I'm back in the host seat asking the questions. And on the weekly roundup, just to remind everyone, we take a retrospective on key events from the previous week in politics. And, well, what a week it was last week, wasn't it? When we left things off 3 or 4 weeks ago before I went on holiday, we did predictions. You know, who was going to win the US election? We both said Trump. Did we get it right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Next question.
let's
expand on that a little bit. One of the interesting things I think to talk about here is there's always been this shy Trump voter effect where he always outperforms his polls. And a lot of the talk before the election this time was whether, because Trump has sort of been in the conversation so much, whether that shy voting effect had gone away and that the polls were actually accurate, or if anything, overstating Trump's popularity. But what we've seen is that he's still outperformed his polls again, that the polls had him about dead even in the popular vote. But he's won the popular vote by about 3.5 percentage points. So they still understated his performance by roughly 3.5%. And it probably varies across the various swing states and stuff like that. But he has outperformed his polls again. So that's an interesting feature.
And looking at, again, you're talking about those polls, they didn't want to gamble on who would win or lose. All right, all the pollsters basically on the last day said 50-50, it's a coin flip. You know, we spent millions of dollars on these models. Nate Silver famously said he ran like 40,000 computations of different scenarios, and it was exactly 50-50, which is a very expensive coin flipping machine. And basically they just didn't want to really engage with what was happening. But there was one man, a Frenchman, who made, I think, $42 million in betting on Trump. And the reason he put tens of millions of dollars on Trump, or I think he may have put 10 million in and got 42 million out, something along those lines. The reason he did it is because he saw that some of the pollsters were asking questions like, who do you think your neighbors are voting for? As you were talking about the shy Trump effect. And when he saw the results of those polls, people thought their neighbors were going to vote for Trump. So if they weren't willing to say they were voting for Trump, they would say, yes, my neighbors are voting for Trump. And he ran his own polls. He even paid a polling company to run secret, you know, private polls that aren't able to be released. And he said all of those polls showed him Trump was going to win. And so he put down $10 million and won very, very big.
That's interesting. Yeah. So one of the suspicions that people have had about the polling in the past, The reason that Trump keeps overperforming his polling, or to put it the other way around, the reason the polls consistently put him down, put his popularity lower than what it really is people think it's sort of suppression. The polling companies deliberately colluding to put Trump's popularity at lower than what he is to discourage his voters from coming out to vote because they think he'll have no chance of winning the election. So that's sort of like, you know, the conspiratorial angle people have on the polling. One of the more interesting things that I think about here is the types of people who have actually come out and voted for Trump. And what's interesting about this is that he's done really well among Latinos. So he's got a historically high number proportion of the Latino or Hispanic voting for him. And this is despite running on like the largest deportation program in U.S. history and talking about Haitian migrants eating cats and dogs. So according to that,
for some reason, hey, that was really popular with the Hispanic voters. It turns out that running on amnesty and importing more and more voters from South America, that doesn't get you the votes. It's the ones that are already there in America that say, you know, hang on a minute, there's a reason I live in America, right? There's a reason I left my country and I came here. And don't want all of that. You know, basically, the previous governments have been importing the reasons why those voters left their countries. And they're realizing that the only way is mass deportations is to fix the problem.
Yeah. So the way the typical political consultant thinks is that you know at all costs you want to avoid saying something to offend the various constituencies. But actually what we're seeing here is something that's working more like the other way around, where people are appreciating Trump's willingness to say what he really thinks, even if it's a little bit offensive. And he's actually won outright Latino men, at least according to some of the exit polls I've been looking at here. And so I think there's this sort of effect where we see this effect in South America, where the Latino personality quite likes the sort of the fiery big man type political.
Yeah, they love their strong man political leaders, yeah. Right? And yeah, you might certainly be right about that. And the other interesting thing there was as well that they were saying Trump was going to lose white women. Basically, women were going to vote against Trump, but his biggest voting bloc, by a little bit, I think his biggest voting bloc, according to these exit polls, were white women, just slightly more than white men. So he did really, really well with women, even though they said, well, women are going to hate Trump and women are going to vote against Trump.
I think you've got that the wrong way around. I think the men were still bigger.
Edged out slightly. Okay, I've seen.
But he's definitely performed better amongst white women and women in general than what was expected. And that's the sort of the tail of the tape, if you will, the story of the whole election. He's performed much better than people anticipated among all these minority groups or groups that he was supposedly offending. So he's done better against women. He's done better amongst the suburban voters, you know, the Latino people. He's even done slightly better amongst black people. Just a little bit, like they still overwhelmingly voted for Kamala, but he's made inroads there as well. So for a long time, there's been this idea of the emerging Democratic majority, which is basically the Democratic way of putting their strategy of importing a new electorate to win elections.
Exactly. They're kind of their rainbow coalition, the people of color strategy. And yeah, they still get the most, but nowhere near enough. It's not going the way that they thought it would go.
No. And even though the Republicans have run this candidate who, by any normal like woke standards, is like offensive and racist and xenophobic and should be offending all these groups and turning them all off, he's still making inroads and winning over more of these multicultural, diverse communities. And so I think it just puts that strategy from the Democrats of importing a new electorate into question, whether that's actually really going to work for them. Because if Trump's winning more of these people, and also while that's happening, that the people in the country are offended and turned off by the Democrats' policies on the border of allowing, you know, just millions of people just to flow over the border, then it's really hurting them more than helping them. So I think, you know, the mass immigration is still an effective way of turning a first world country into a third world country, but it may not be an effective way of securing a permanent Democratic majority. So I don't think that's for certain, but I think Trump's victory and the fact that he's made such inroads into these minority communities certainly puts that in question. And it's certainly something for the Democrats to think about.
And the one other demographic that's interesting to mention is the American Indians. So he won an overwhelming majority of American Indians as well. They make up about 1% of the electorate. So it's not a huge constituency. But again, you'd think that we get all of this wokeness imported here as well, like land recognition and the stuff that about, you know, the original owners of this land, the real owners, blah, 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 tribe, this and that thing. You think that all of these Native Americans are crazy woke people. But no. In about 60, 64, 67% of Americans, I said Native, should specifically say American Indians voted for Trump. So the woke have put together this crazy idea about how the Indians are going to behave, and that's not how, they're doing the complete opposite. They're voting for Trump.
That's right. They've actually, American Indians have voted for Trump in higher proportions than white people. And this is despite the constant narratives we hear coming out about, you know, indigenous people and colonization and white people, you know, stealing the land and, you know, basically committing genocide against the indigenous people. They didn't buy that at all.
No.
That was the most popular demographic group in terms of voting for Trump. I find that quite incredible, really. And it really, you know, the Democrats really need to reconsider whether these weaponized narratives they're deploying about colonialism and indigenous people and white people being evil are really doing the trick.
Mm. And this brings us to another point, which is what resonated well. Is this a rejection of wokeness? And is there a complete demoralization now among the left? You know, they were sort of expecting, even if it was close, maybe they could say, oh, the Electoral College is bad, we won the popular vote, and they'd have all kinds of things they could say that somehow they made some inroads and their, you know, their strategy is still valid. But it seems like they have been completely deflated. Like everything they believed in, everything the media was telling them, all of it was a lie. All of it failed. And even across the entire world, it seems like the leftist movement, the progressive movement, just came to a dead halt overnight. They woke up the next morning and realized they've got nothing.
I think it is a significant part of it, the rejection of wokeness. I don't think that's the sole story. I think a big part of it, Trump would often open his rallies with the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And I think that that sort of basic question of economic well-being formed a big part of it as well. Because, you know, the economy, the stock market, jobs, everything went, you know, extremely well under the Trump administration until the COVID pandemic came out and sort of hurt the economy in the final few months or the final year of his presidency. But Trump, he also campaigned very strongly on these questions like immigration, about the trans issue, you know, mm-hmm. teaching kids about trans stuff in schools and getting trans people out of women's toilets and women's sports. All these various woke issues featured strongly in the campaign as well. And so it's a combination of those two things, the basic, it's the economy stupid question and the rejection of the woke social and cultural issues, in my view. And you've also asked-
It makes sense in the sense of basically him saying, like, you know, do we have a country? Right? And you've seen a number of Trump allies saying this, well, do we have a country? Do we want a country? Or does the country cease to exist? And that all comes together, like all of this between wokeness and the Great Replacement and economic nationalism. These things all come together. You either have a country or you don't have a country. And he basically made it about that issue.
Yeah, they're not just transing the kids, the gender identity. They're transing the national identity too.
Yeah, exactly. It all comes together into one big question. And I read just this morning that the ad that did the best, basically, in the Trump campaign that they ran for months and repeatedly, and they ran it in blue states, which helped them, I think, flip the popular vote. They ran the same ad over and over and over again, and the ad simply said, Kamala Harris is with they/them, Donald Trump is with you.
Yeah, well, the trans issue is maybe one of the closest things that the right have stumbled upon to, like, kryptonite for the progressive left. So that's a terrible issue, I think. Whether they're going to wholesale reject wokeness, I'm sort of skeptical of. They're so bought in now, I'm not sure how they could. But if they're going to have any chance electorally, they're definitely going to have to reassess how they think and what they say about the trans issue. Because as Jordan Peterson has said, some of the stuff that's going on with the trans stuff is, and this is what Peterson said, it's just as bad as what has happened in the camps in Nazi Germany to the Jews. This is Mengele tier stuff they're doing to kids with these experimental surgeries, the hormone treatments, all this stuff. It's simply inhumane and cannot be allowed to continue. And if you're promoting that, you deserve to lose and you need to lose. It's vital that you lose.
And speaking about that issue then, because the mainstream media was all in on this. And this really seems like it was an alternative media election, a new media election. It was Elon Musk's X platform. It was the podcasts. You could almost compare this to Obama's Facebook election, sort of where Barack Obama was the first candidate of any, you know, major significance around the world who harnessed social media. And Donald Trump seems to this time have fully harnessed the next phase of what social media is. And the mainstream media, they're still confused. You know, days later, they've completely lost their minds. They've got nowhere to go. Like, they seem to know it's the end for them, but they have no off-ramp.
Well, if you remember back to 2016, Trump was very effective in his use of Twitter. He was the undisputed Twitter king. And he used Twitter to go around the mainstream media very effectively and get his message out, his politically incorrect message, his politically incorrect tweets that went viral. And at the same time, he campaigned against the mainstream media. He called them fake news, and he made that trend. And that really, when you look at the effectiveness of that label of calling them fake news, that was the beginning of the end for the mainstream media and mainstream media influence. That was a rhetorical kill shot that destroyed their credibility, because once he'd said it, and once people got a hold of this alternative information from social media and elsewhere, they could sort of compare and decide for themselves. And people increasingly could see for themselves that the narratives they were getting out of the mainstream media were largely fake, very biased, and often openly hostile to like the values and the worldview and the aspirations of ordinary and particular conservative people, conservative Americans and conservative people in other countries too. And so we've had this situation where the mainstream media credibility has been destroyed, along with the credibility of many other institutions in Western society. People are increasingly getting their information now from social media, which is a trend that was happening anyway, but has been accelerated by the death of the credibility of mainstream media. And so this time around, Trump very effectively, rather than using Twitter — he still used Twitter a bit, but not in the same way, not with his viral tweets — but he very effectively leveraged use of the podcasting ecosystem, including people like Joe Rogan. And so in previous elections, people have campaigned for the endorsements of major newspapers and things like that. And in this election, Donald Trump was gunned for the endorsement of Joe Rogan. And it's easy to see why when you look at the audience that Joe Rogan has. He has an audience now that's greater than many of these large newspapers and large mainstream media television companies. And so he used the podcasting system very well. He went on lots of independent podcasts, and not just Joe Rogan's one. And so did his running mate J.D. Vance and other people connected with the campaign, like Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy. They were all over the podcasts and the independent media scene. And that's probably has a lot to do with why they did so well among young people. Didn't win young people outright, but they made significant inroads into the Democrats' traditional dominance of the under 30 demographic. And I think that's because young people are getting their news from these podcasts, and Trump and his allies went on the podcasts and talked to people and were able to explain their worldviews to these young people. So it's a changing of the guard in terms of media, what type of media has influence, and how politicians are going to have to interact with media in order to win votes. Very interesting.
And you've mentioned some of the team who helped make this happen for Trump as well, because it's no longer just the Trump campaign, Trump election in 2016. It was definitely Trump. 2020, it was Trump. And now we're looking at the MAGA movement, kind of who is the heir to the MAGA movement. We're seeing J.D. Vance again doing a very good job of that. Elon Musk getting on board. Kennedy, RFK on board there. Even Trump's youngest son, Barron Trump, apparently was very influential in convincing him to go on this podcast episode, doing the podcasts. And this was kind of memed into reality. Like the campaign really played into the memes that Trump supporters came up with, and that the MAGA movement came up with online, and they sort of turned them into a little bit of reality. So it wasn't just the viral Trump posts that Trump was making. They were taking ideas from his supporters and then kind of leveraging them into bigger memes. And one of those memes was that Barron Trump was going to be important and special. And that had been going on for a few years now online. And then we find out just near the end of the campaign, Trump, thanking Barron, saying, "Oh, he's so influential. He gives me advice all the time. I take my campaign advice from Barron," kind of giving a nod to people who have been theorizing about this for years.
Well, I just think he's a good dad, and he's trying to help his son out. That's what I would do if I was in that position too, like get your son involved. But the way you're right though, he's created this group of people around him now. He's got a team. He's put together a team, to quote another meme. And the way Trump works, the way he sort of functions in the media ecosystem, is he's like the tip of the spear. And his job is to go where no other man would go, and go there boldly. What's the Star Trek saying? I've kind of mucked it up.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
That's right. That's right. And he says the things that are unsayable, but that are right. And that's the very, very first thing he did when he came down the escalator in 2015. He talked about immigration. You remember he said something like, they're not sending their best. They're rapists, they're murderers, and some, I assume, are good people, which kind of seems like backwards to most people. They would think, well, most of them are good people, but, you know, there are some rapists and murderers too. Maybe there's too many rapists and murderers. But that's what he does. He broaches the difficult issues, and he creates a discussion about it, creates a discussion piece, often by saying things that are kind of incorrect. Like, so he's directionally correct, but he gets some of the details wrong. But even when people go in to try and criticize him and clarify the details, what they're doing is that they're bringing attention to the issue. And even the clarification that they issue in the end still ends up sort of making the case for basically the same point that Trump wanted to make in the end. So he's very effective in that sense. And then he's got this team now, this coterie of Trump explainers that he's put together, who then have developed the intellectual justifications and explain that to the wider population for these positions that Trump goes out and puts out into the ecosystem by talking about, for example, Haitian migrants eating dogs and cats. That was Trump broaches the issue with that sort of the funny viral meme. And then someone comes in and explains after him, well, actually, I mean, there is a serious issue with Haitian migrants. You know, they are sort of, they have a different set of social norms that are creating trouble for the communities they come into. Maybe they have sort of lower IQs and don't fit in as well and end up lowering the socioeconomic quality of the community around them, or things like this. So he broaches the subject, other people come in and explain it, and that dynamic is good for winning the argument and moving the needle, moving the Overton window, and moving the policy consensus of the electorate. And it's been very effective.
And this was the problem with the first Trump administration, staffing, basically finding loyal people who knew what they were doing. And often he'd end up getting these people who would just pretend to be loyal to him, sort of, or who'd just say what he wanted to hear, and then they'd go off and stab him in the back and undermine his administration. And it seems like now he's got a far more solid team of people who really understand him, who have gone through the tough times with him together, who are now going to go to Washington with him, and behind the scenes they've put this team together. It seems like things may actually change. I don't want to get ahead of things here. But the biggest criticism of like the first Trump administration was basically that he couldn't ultimately deliver on the big ticket items. He didn't dismantle the swamp. Kind of the swamp beat him in a way. And this is the moment for him to redeem himself to his voters and say, I've done the hard work behind the scenes in these 4 years in of exile in the wilderness, and I'm coming back and we're going to actually deliver.
Well, there's a saying that personnel is policy. It's not enough just to have the ideas. You have to have the people in the right positions in order, in the bureaucracy and elsewhere, in order to implement the policy ideas that you've campaigned on and won on. And so I think they've internalized that lesson now, and hopefully they can do it. I saw a clip of J.D. Vance talking to a podcaster about this very issue, and he said, well, look, people talk a lot about sort of checks and balances. And people talk as if the hostile members of the executive branch, the hostile bureaucrats who refuse to implement Trump's policies, they talk as if that was part and parcel of the checks and balances. But that's not where the checks and balances are supposed to come from. Trump is the head of that branch of government. And those people have to follow his orders. The checks and balances come from the Senate and the Congress and perhaps the Supreme Court as well. But those people have to follow his orders. And all the talk, you remember all the talk, they talk about the guardrails, the media, and all this stuff. They talked as if defiance from the bureaucrats in these branches was part of the system of checks and balances, and that the guard, if they didn't do what Trump said, that was a good thing. That was the guardrails holding. Well, I think that whole way of thinking is a deception. I think it seems as if, and you're right, we have to see, but it seems as if they have put real thought into how they're going to replace the top tier of the bureaucracy with people who are loyal to them and who will implement their policy agenda. And I hope that that's what happens.
And we see this in New Zealand as well. Just to take a very quick step away from the US elections, you see headlines all the time from the New Zealand mainstream media saying, Minister ABC ignored advice from bureaucrats or experts or expert, you know, ignored the advice. And it's like, well, where is the advice coming from? It's coming from these bureaucrats who are in these agencies who oppose the government's agenda. But they shouldn't be doing that. They should be implementing the agenda of the government, because the whole point is the minister has come in with a policy that is his job to implement, and then the bureaucracy needs to implement that policy. And of course, if they're ideologically opposed to him, they're going to give him expert advice saying the opposite, and of course he's going to ignore that. And so yeah, the media tries to play that against the electorate and to make people think, oh, the minister he's being silly, he's dumb, or he's being deceptive because he's ignoring this magic advice he's been given. It's like, no, he's got a policy mandate and he needs to implement his policy mandate, and these people who are giving this so-called advice, they just need to be quiet and go away and do their jobs.
Yeah, advice is just advice. When you're a minister, you've been elected by the people to be the decision maker. That's your job, to make the final decision. And making the final decision sometimes means rejecting the advice. And you can reject the advice because you disagree with it. You can reject the advice because you're unsure about you're unsure whether it's accurate, whether perhaps it's been it's motivated and being provided to you by people who are hostile to your agenda. These are all legitimate things for a minister who is a final decision maker to do. That's your job, in fact, to do that. Making decisions sometimes means rejecting the official advice.
Now, back to the US elections. In the few days since the election, we've seen already stocks go up, Bitcoin in particular. Trump has promised to be the Bitcoin president, to build a reserve of Bitcoin assets and so on. So the prices of all of these economic assets are going wild. And it basically, as far as I can tell, the big movers in the economy, in the global economy, are predicting very heavily that this is going to be a time of prosperity under Trump, because otherwise you wouldn't get such a positive reaction from the economic markets, which runs contrary to what, of course, again, the mainstream media propaganda and narrative has been, that there's going to be economic uncertainty. It's going to be the end of free trade. Trump's going to destroy free trade, and he's going to run trillions of dollars deficits, and inflation's going to go wild. And yet the people who actually have the money in the markets are saying the complete opposite with, you know, when it comes to their actual money.
Well, it shouldn't be surprising that the markets are excited, because the markets and the economy did extremely well under the first Trump administration. I have investments. I follow what the stock market does. And under the last Trump administration, the stock market shot up like that. It was very high. In case you missed that, Trump told us that repeatedly. He was one of the biggest cheerleaders for the stock market. He'd come out every week and talk up the stock market, tell us how good it was, bragging about his performance. But also, you know, that when the Reserve Bank does that, they call it open mouth operations, right? It's when the official people come out, they can actually affect the market. So maybe Trump thought that's what he was doing as well. And maybe it even worked. But it's not surprising for things to go up, because they went up last time. I don't know what Trump does exactly to encourage the markets to go up. I think some of his economic policies are very good. He cut lots of regulations last time, and there's every indication he might do similar things again. He's promising to cut corporate tax rates, and that would likely help the economy. Some of his other economic policies is tariffs. People are sort of divided on that, but if that encourages lots of big businesses to relocate into the US and employ US workers, that could do wonders for the US economy as well. So there's lots of reasons to be optimistic, and things have been rather poor under the Biden-Kamala administration. So I think it's reasonable to expect that things will get better.
And to take this from the economy to politics in general, do you think this is a turning point then in the United States and Western politics. Are we going to see these trends continue? We've seen the German government just collapse late last week, and there may be snap elections coming up soon. We've seen in trends in Europe similarly heading in his direction, trends in New Zealand heading in the right direction. Are the next 4 years going to be very positive, do you think, in Western politics? Will this be repeated elsewhere?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think this whole thing, we've had Brexit, we had the first Trump administration, we've had populist right-wing anti-immigration parties doing well in Europe and elsewhere. There's a trend here, and the second Trump administration is a continuation of that trend. When he won his first election in 2016, the authorities could be forgiven for being taken by surprise there and not anticipating it. That can't be the case in 2024. Everyone knew what to expect from a Trump administration because he'd been there before and done it before. And the people voted for it again anyway. It wasn't that they didn't know what they were getting. They knew what they were getting, and they decided that they liked that. And that sends, I think, a very powerful signal, and particularly since, as we discussed earlier, he's won over a lot of these woke, diversity, multicultural demographics. He's actually done better with a lot of those demographics. So that really blows the whole Democratic left-wing strategy of assembling a coalition of agitated minorities. It really brings that into question, whether that strategy is going to be an effective political organizing strategy for them going forward, or they're going to have to reassess how they do their politics in the future.
And the final question before we move on to more local issues, because we do have some of those to get into as well, but very important question is, the Democrats, the media, the bureaucracy, they've all been saying Trump is literally Hitler. American fascism, he's going to create the fascist global super turbo fascist state or whatever, and he's literally Hitler. And now they're all conceding the election to him, and they're all going to peacefully transfer power to the literally Hitler. Is that going to happen? I mean, that seems absurd. Were they lying this whole time? Are they planning something in the background? Because that seems absurd, right? You can't just say this somebody's a threat to democracy and it's going to install fascism and it's going to be the worst thing ever, and then say, oh yes, congratulations, you won the election, here you go, it's all yours.
Yeah, well, there are some people who believe he's literally Hitler. I was reading today that there are people in the US, very highly liberal people, who are committing suicide because of Trump's victory. And, you know, that's really an indictment of how sort of revved up and hyped up the media have got people about Trump being supposedly evil and being supposedly Hitler. This is, young people are killing themselves because they're so bought into this idea. So that's terrible, I think. And what this sort of suggests to me is that the fact that they basically called him Hitler and then he won anyway, they knew that that was an exaggeration, or if not an outright lie. And they said it anyway because they thought it might help them win. But they used all their rhetorical tools. They used them to the maximum they could. And Trump won anyway. So what that's going to do is it's going to weaken the effectiveness of those rhetorical tools moving into the future. Nassim Nicholas Taleb has this idea of anti-fragility, right? Where not only do you, when you're called all the bad names, not only does it stop hurting you, but actually somehow, like, when people call you the bad names, it actually helps you in a way. And I think there was a little bit of that dynamic going on with Trump. The more he sort of got, I mean, this is a man who was impeached twice and survived two assassination attempts.
And convicted felonies and blah, 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 on it goes, right?
Yeah, that calling him Hitler and treating him so unfairly actually ended up helping him, right? I think it maybe.
Yeah, I would agree. I think people looked at that. People looked at that and said, you know, obviously that's not true. And even now, after the election, people, maybe 2020 was stolen. Maybe that last election was, you know, maybe with everything that they've done, maybe they were willing to commit fraud then, and people changed their vote based on that, possibly, to say, I'm with the underdog. Very American thing as well.
So I think that the long run consequences of this is that he's shown that you can run directly into the line of fire and absorb everything they've got in terms of calling you Hitler, impeaching you, doing all these things to you, and you can win anyway. So these are tools of sort of mimetic containment. These are tools of, you know, speech policing, thought policing, and in the end, like policing what people vote for. And that containment system, hopefully, with Trump's victory, has been sort of blown out of the water, and we'll have to go back to something more like normal politics, where people actually have to make the case for their policy decisions rather than compete over who can yell Hitler the loudest.
Well, we'll wrap up the US election there, but we'll continue on the subject of free speech and more close to home. We've had a recent court case, and I've seen very little about this because I was on holiday, but I'm sure you can fill me in and the audience in. There was a court judgment against Pauline Hanson, leader of One Nation in Australia, and saying that she had racially vilified some other person. Perhaps you could tell us who it is and what this racial vilification potentially was, and then what the implications are for freedom of speech in Australia.
So it concerns a tweet by Pauline Hanson towards another senator, a Pakistani senator called Mehreen Farooqi, a female Pakistani senator, I believe. And basically what happened is that after the passing of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, the Pakistani senator said something like, "I find it difficult to mourn the leader of a racist colonialist empire," or something like that. And in response to that, Pauline Hanson tweeted something along the lines of, there was something that came before it expressing displeasure with the tweet. And then she said, "If you don't like it, you can piss off back to Pakistan," something like that. And a judge has found that the piss off back to Pakistan thing amounts to a sort of racial vilification. She's been found guilty under racial vilification laws.
Which is absurd, like patently absurd.
So there's a few things to say here. First of all, the thing that Pauline Hanson was responding to is arguably sort of hateful in a certain way. It's sort of disparaging towards the British Empire, British people, white people, white Australians, and so forth. And
people should be almost afraid to do something like criticize say disgusting things about our culture and our institutions. They shouldn't be vilifying those, especially if someone's an immigrant. Like, I mean, hey, I'm an immigrant here in New Zealand. I'm not going to go and say nasty things about New Zealand's institutions and New Zealand's history and all of that. That's actually a very disgusting thing for an immigrant to be doing. And I think Pauline Hanson's response is perfectly reasonable in that case.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, I kind of feel that way too. I mean, I think that the Pakistani senator should be legally able to say what she said, but Pauline Hanson should be able to respond in the way that I think many other Australians are sort of feeling as well. Then what this judgment does is it effectively, it kind of criminalizes a political idea under the rubric or the pretense of racial vilification. There's a political idea that Pauline Hanson is expressing here, and it's an idea that won't be popular with a lot of people, and many people, particularly people on the left, find disgusting. But nevertheless, it's a political idea that in a free country you ought to be able to voice. And that's that if people come to a country and they don't like it and they agitate against it and they say horrible things about it, then maybe they should go back. A lot of people find that a reasonable sort of a thing to say. And that's basically the thing that Pauline Hanson was getting at. But she's been told that expressing that sentiment is illegal. So this is.
I believe she was just simply fined, right? She wasn't like at risk of prison, but she's definitely given a hefty fine for it.
Yeah, no, she's not in prison. She's being fined, yeah. But it's the cost of going through all the legal cases that are really the bigger thing.
And the suppression of freedom of speech and people's political ideas, as you said, right? No one else, or now everyone else is in Australia, has got to give a second thought to what they're saying because of someone's race. To be like, oh, maybe, you know, I can't say back to them what they say to me because that's illegal. So it's fine for them to be racially abusive about my culture and country, but I can't say a single thing back to them because then I'll get fined $20,000 and get dragged through the courts.
Yeah, and we've just had this is one of the biggest political issues in the contemporary political debate in the Western world is over immigration and multiculturalism, the limits to multiculturalism, whether if you import people who are hostile to your culture, whether that's wise, whether we've done too much of that, particularly with perhaps Muslim immigrants in Europe who is committing a lot of knife crime. They're not assimilating very well. Perhaps it was a mistake to have invited so many of them there. People are campaigning on remigration. Trump campaigned on the largest domestic deportation of immigrants. This is a live political issue. And that the judgment in this case weighs in on people's political speech on that issue to be able to give voice to one side of the argument, which is basically people who don't fit in here and criticize and undermine our society and our culture and our way of life ought to go back. That's a political view, and you ought to be able to say it.
And in New Zealand, how are things going with our hate speech activities by the New Zealand police? While I was on holiday, I got an email from the Free Speech Union, so sort of celebrating a bit of a victory against the police, saying the police had backed off on their hate crime training. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, so the Free Speech Union have kind of claimed victory here. They're saying that the police commissioner has agreed to review the hate speech and hate crime training that police officers are giving, review the training materials, and really take a hard look at the hate crimes or the hate speech incidents that they're recording and classifying. And they've changed the definition. They've said they're going to change the definition of what counts as hate speech or a hate crime to move away from a perception-based standard to a different standard. And the standard has to do with when there's a reasonable sort of people can reasonably be said to be in danger of physical harm resulting from the speech. So that's sort of movement in the right direction, but it's still linked to these protected characteristics like race and sex and sexuality. So I'm just not sure that this is really as much of a victory as what the Free Speech Union is claiming, because if we go and we have a look at something like the Christchurch call, for example, and the work Jacinda Ardern was doing there, they're very keen to conflate people who disagree with them with violent extremists already. You don't actually have to be violent to be called a violent extremist. They just say that you're violent because they don't like your ideas. And so if the police are still saying, oh, there has to be a reasonable sort of danger that people's physical safety is jeopardized, you know, that doesn't really matter, because they just say that the physical safety is jeopardized. There doesn't have to be any real evidence for them to do it, that they're making these claims already. And because it only applies, because the protected characteristics are only things like race, sex, sexuality, it biases the playing field in favor of left-wing ideas. So left-wing ideas are protected and right-wing ideas are effectively made to be hate speech. So I think what really needs to happen here is that these protected characteristics need to be taken out of law, because as long as they're there, people are going to find ways to sort of leverage them to suppress or punish people for right-wing speech. And this is exactly what's happened in the case of Pauline Hanson that we just discussed, right? She's been accused of racial vilification, right? But what she's really done is express a political idea. And that political idea is that people who come into your country and disrespect it and don't appreciate it and don't assimilate ought to go back. And so you can see how these ideas of racial vilification, of hate speech against people because of their sexuality and things, that they're leveraged by people who are very clever into targeting people for political ideas, suppressing their speech and personally punishing them. And this all works in one direction ideologically. So that's why I think they need to be taken out of law.
And we have just a little bit of time to talk about one more court case, which is sort of related to free speech. I think it's an important free speech issue. Brian Tamaki has been in court over protests that he led against the COVID tyranny, the lockdowns, and I unfortunately haven't been able to follow the case closely, but I'm sure you have done so a little bit more than I have, and you can tell us a little bit about how it's going. But I believe the Crown, the police, are still trying to prosecute him over breaking social distancing rules. Well, they weren't even laws. They weren't laws. They were like made up rules from 5-6 years ago, whenever that was 5 years ago, a long time ago now, 4 years ago. And they're still trying to go after him for that. And we know for the most part it was bogus, all the stuff that, you know, basically Brian Tumaki was right. And there, how do you think that court case is going to go and the impact it'll have?
Well, I'm not going to play guessing games about how the court case is going to go.
What's your impression of you know, what the arguments that have been made by Brian Tumaki's side?
Well, Brian Tumaki, I think, deserves great credit. He was one of the first people who got the protests going against a lot of the authoritarian measures that were happening during the COVID lockdowns and the mandates and with the vaccine passports. So he recognized early on, and he had the ability and the willingness to put himself out there and organize these protests. And he really, more than anyone, really got it going. I mean, there are lots of other people involved too, but he did a lot at the beginning to get the ball rolling. And so I think he deserves great credit. He's already spent time in prison for doing this. He spent, 10 days or something in solitary confinement or something ridiculous. And what I understand is that part of his bail conditions were that he wasn't allowed to go out and run any more protests or do any more demonstrations, and he did. And so that's why they're going after him. But of course, these are all, he should never have been targeted by police in the first place. People have a right to protest. They have a right to organize when they think the government is treating them unfairly. And to say, well, it's a lockdown, you're not allowed to organize a protest. And then when you do organize a protest, well, you're breaking the rules, and now we're going to punish you more. I think this is really bringing into focus the sort of injustice of the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, even the process is the punishment, right? The whole thing is completely unjust. Whatever the outcome is going to be, the whole thing has been an injustice.
So Brian Tumaki is, he's unpopular and controversial with a lot of people, but I see a guy who stood up and did the right thing and showed a lot of courage and is taking the heat for it. So, I mean, I'm behind Brian Tumaki. I think he's doing the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was at the time, I thought, this is great that you're doing this. I was hesitant to be associated too much, but fully supportive of what he was doing. And yeah, again, like I said, he was basically singled out there and punished. There are a few other people as well that we could talk about who were punished as well. Basically, the government and the police were trying to just basically say to other people, we're making an example of them. You'd better watch out. It's the exact same thing when it comes to the police hate speech we were just talking about, Pauline Hanson case we were talking about in Australia. It's all making an example of these people. We're making sure that you know that we're making an example of them, so you're going to keep your mouth shut, so you're not going to protest the government.
That's basically it. But is it working? Or is it having the opposite effect? And that's
I think the fact that we're here talking about this is proof that the pushback is only growing, but it means that more and more people need to be willing to put something real on the line and do something about it. Because obviously, if you don't, well, then they win. So you've got no choice. You've got to get out there and you've got to fight, as Trump said when after the attempted assassination, fight, fight, fight. I think we should apply that everywhere.
Well, that's the danger with implementing authoritarian measures and persecuting your political enemies. Once you start doing it, you have to kind of keep doing it if they fight back. And you really need to assess at the beginning whether you're really willing to go all the way with these authoritarian measures and oppress and defeat and persecute your political enemies to the fullest extent to defeat them completely. Because if you're not willing to go all the way, you really should have thought about that at the beginning and not did it. There's a great play by Shakespeare called Macbeth where it really talks about this, where he sort of, I wish I could remember some of the soliloquies that quote them here, but I can't. But go look up that.
Shakespeare and Macbeth is a great place to end this. We are basically out of time for today. And thank you very much, William, for joining me these past 2 hours. As I said right at the beginning, I quickly kind of put together a show having come back from holiday, and it's just William offered to kind of step in for the whole 2 hours. And don't worry, next week we'll have guests, we'll get back into things, but it was either just replays this week or William and I just getting up and putting together what we could. And I think we filled up the whole 2 hours, basically. So cheers for that. And we will be back with the weekly roundup next week.
Thanks, Dewa. It's great to have you back.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.